right? Now let me explain to you a little bit here about what's happening. There is a segment of this semester that we call cost-output determination. And this is the first chapter of that segment. It's a major segment of this semester. But what we're doing here, starting today, is that we're going to assume that we own a business. And as owners of a business, we want to make certain decisions. Now, what is microeconomics all about? Come on now. Macroeconomics, microeconomics. This semester is microeconomics. Another term is called price theory. And its main objective is learning how to make right decisions, right? It involves the decision-making process of economics. So, we're going to assume that we own a business. And as an owner of a business, we want to make certain decisions. See, for example, we want to know what price should we charge to maximize our profit. Now, being an owner of a business, we don't want to just make any old profit. We want to make the most money possible, right? We want to maximize our profit. Now, in order to maximize our profit, we have to know, for example, what price to charge. If we charge too high of a price, we'll make less money. If we charge too low of a price, we'll make less money. There's only one unique price that we can charge whereby we will maximize our profit. Same with quantity. There's only one unique quantity that we can produce whereby we will maximize our profit. If we produce more than that, we make less money. Less than that, we make less money. So what exactly is the number? What quantity should we produce to maximize our profit? Now, it may come to where we cannot make a profit. But in this case, we would want to minimize our losses. Now, why would a business operate while it's making a loss? Why would it be a good idea right here, right now, today, to operate while making a loss? What? Well, that's possible. I mean, that is an answer. That wasn't the answer I was thinking of, but that would be an answer that we're looking over the long term and we're looking at stability and maybe the secure market. That's very possible. But another reason would be that our losses are less than our fixed costs. Because in the short run, we have fixed costs. We have certain expenses. And if our losses are less than our expenses, then we will want to continue to operate. And if we do that, we still want to know what price to charge and what quantity to produce to minimize our losses. Now, if it's a case of profit maximization, we also want to know, well, what are our profits at a point of profit maximization? And if it's a case of loss minimization, what is our loss at the point of loss minimization? Now, before we really get into this, because see, what we do here while we're answering these questions and learning how to evaluate, we divide the economy up into four different sectors. There's a perfect competition, or four type of markets, I should say. There's a perfectly competitive type market. And then on the other extreme, there's a monopoly type market, where you only have one producer. And then in between those two extremes, there is monopolistic competition, and oligopoly. Now, every business falls into one of these four type of markets: perfect competition, monopoly, monopolist competition, oligopoly. So what we do here, first of all, we have this introductory chapter, chapter 7, production and cost of the firm, where we simply learn certain vocabulary and certain concepts that is going to lead us into this segment of price output determination. And then what we do is that we have a whole chapter on perfect competition. We say, well, okay, this would be chapter 8. We would say, let's say that you're a member of a perfectly competitive market. What would your decision-making process look like? And then in the next chapter, we look at a monopoly. We say, what would happen if you were part of a monopolistic market? You were a monopoly. What would your decision-making process look like? And then we say, what would happen if you're part of a monopolist competitive market? What would happen if you're a part of an oligopolistic market? And then that will end this section. That's about 5 or 6 chapters. That's going to end this segment here of what is called price output determination. So that's the direction that we're headed starting in this chapter. And let me just say this. If you ever have to take a standardized test, like for business school, like let's say you get a 4-year degree and you want to get an MBA and you have to take some kind of test, a big part of that test will be economics, because it's so central to any business curriculum. And test makers love to test students on this segment, because this is so central to the topic of microeconomics. So, plus another reason they like to use this segment to test students is that we're going to do a lot of interpretation of graphs and charts. There's some mathematics here. There's several graphs we look at, charts we look at. We have to learn how to glean information from these charts and from these graphs to answer certain questions, to come up with certain solutions. And test makers love this. They love to give you a graph, and then they say, looking at this graph, they'll ask you certain questions, or it'll be a table. Looking at this table, here are certain questions. Can you glean from this table the answers to these questions? And so because test makers love to do that, that's a big part of this chapter. Okay, I mean of this segment of price output determination. Okay, so let's just get on here with this chapter 7. I'm sure I got ahead of myself, but what I try to do is give you an overview of where we're going and the reason we're going there. So the first slide here says, when studying production and costs of the firm, what assumption do I make? And the answer is, producers always attempt to maximize their profit. Now, is this always true? I mean, in the real world, is their number one goal is to maximize profit? No, it's not. There might be other goals, like securing your place in the market, or there may be other things to come into it other than, I mean, your number one priority may not be to maximize your profit, although sometime very often that is the main goal. But the point I'm making is that in this course here, we are going to assume that maximizing profit is the number one priority. All right? Okay. All right, when studying the firm, what is the first thing for me to know? You must have a working knowledge of key terms. And that's what we're going to spend this chapter on. Terms and concepts. What should I do to understand this chapter? We pretend that you are the owner of a business and you are making decisions to maximize your profit or minimize your losses. Okay, so the first term that we talk about here is revenue. What is revenue? Revenue is defined as price times quantity. Revenue, the definition of revenue is simply money in. What price did you charge for your product? How many units did you sell? Price times quantity equals total revenue. So what is profit? Well, profit is total revenue minus total cost. So profit's not the same as revenue. Revenue is simply money in. Profit is money in minus money out. So those are two different terms. All right? Total revenue minus total cost equals profit. So what is an explicit cost? Opportunity cost of a firm's resource that takes the firm a form of cash payments. Now, the way I like to look at it is that anything that you could write a check for, now when I say you, what do I mean by you? Well, what I mean by you is you as an owner of a business, right? See, got to set yourself here as an owner of a business. So as owner of a business, anything that you could write a check for would be called an explicit cost. Well, you'll find. See, I'm going to compare.
Credit cards be like explicit cost?
Well, if you're paying for that credit card, it would be. If you have a fee for that credit card, if the credit card company charges you a fee, it would be.
With the credit card.
Doesn't make any difference how you pay it. And now, what I'm saying here is that anything you could use a check for, you could. Like materials, like labor. Like certain transportation, you pay for your utilities, things like that, your power.
See,
anything you could use a check. I mean, you can use a debit card if you want, or put it on a credit card, or no matter how you pay for it. But I mean, if it's possible to write a check for it, then that's what we call an explicit cost. All right. Now, this is compared to an implicit cost. An implicit cost is a firm's opportunity cost of using its own resources or those provided by its owners without corresponding cash payment. Implicit cost. Now, again, sometimes it's hard to understand these things unless you simply get an example. So let's say that you own a small country store, and you are the only you're the owner of the store, and you have no employees, and you pay for everything in cash. So you buy food and gasoline, things like that. You're the only one that works there. You pay for everything in cash. You've got a storefront on a main road. Now, what would be some examples of your explicit costs? Well, those things I just mentioned, right? I mean, the company comes in to fill your cigarette machine, and you pay them, right? You write them a check. All the food comes in, you pay that company, the ice cream, gasoline, et cetera, right? Insurance would be an explicit cost. Taxes, property taxes would be an explicit cost. But what would be examples of possible Now, I'm not saying these would be explicit costs, implicit costs for sure, but what could be an example of an implicit cost? Well, what's wrong with paying for your merchandise in cash? Anybody know? And what is the disadvantage of paying for it right now?
That money comes out of your pocket right now?
Yeah, but what's the disadvantage in that? What's your cost? Now, what's your implicit cost? Your explicit cost would be what you pay for the food, but what would be your possible implicit cost? Now, what? Yeah, very good. Now, how'd you know that? That's very good. I didn't expect anyone to answer that one. you see, in the food business, normally the way it works is that 30 days is good as cash. Your products are delivered, and as long as you pay for it within 30 days, you pay no interest on it. See, that way, the wholesaler can sell you merchandise, and then you can sell the merchandise in the 30 days and therefore make money and pay for the merchandise. See, that's the thinking behind it. But what's the possible implicit cost? Well, instead of paying for your merchandise up front as they're delivered, let's take this money. How much money are we talking about? Let's say it's $10,000. Let's take our $10,000, put it in the bank, and earn interest on the money. And then, just before the end of the 30 days, we can take our money out and pay for our merchandise. And how much have we earned in interest? Well, I don't know. Let's say we earned $300 in interest. So, if that is possible, what is our implicit cost of paying for our merchandise when it's delivered? $300. Because we have given up. See, what is our opportunity cost of paying for food right now? Well, yeah, $10,000. Our opportunity cost is that which we gave up. So what have we given up for paying for food right now? What we would have given up is the interest that we could have earned on the money, correct? In this case, $300. So $300 is our implicit cost. Now, what about you own the store, you have no employees, so you run the store yourself. What could be some implicit costs? Come on now. What could be an implicit cost? Well, the question is, how much money could you make if you weren't at the store all day long? I mean, let's say that you've got a law degree. And let's say that by running the store, you can make, maybe $500 a day. But as a lawyer, maybe you could make $1,000 a day. Well, if you would hire someone to run the store, and you go practice law, you can make a whole lot more money, right? So by not practicing law and operating the store yourself, what's your implicit cost? Yeah, a day, right? Your implicit cost is that what you've given up because you're running the store instead of practicing law. Now, that's if you were a lawyer. So, I mean, now I'm not saying that. What we're talking about here is what could be possible implicit cost. But the point is here, see, in order to be a shrewd decision maker, you've always got to ask yourself, well, now, if I do this, what's my opportunity cost? Remember, the core to proper decision making is the awareness of opportunity cost. You've always got to ask yourself, well, if I do this, I can make this much money, but if I do something else, how much money could I make? Remember the example I gave of painting your room? Your room needs painting. Well, should you paint the room yourself or hire somebody? And what's the answer? Yeah. In other words, how much you got to pay someone to paint the room, and how much you could make if you were not painting the room yourself, right? If you've got to pay someone $10 an hour, but you could make $25 an hour doing something else, then you paint the room yourself or hire somebody. You hire somebody. That way, you're $15 an hour better off, and you still get the room painted, right? Now, if you've got to pay someone, let's say, $20 an hour to paint the room, but you can only make $10 an hour, yeah, then it's better to paint it yourself. Well, see, same with this. I mean, if you're operating the store and you yourself, you got to say, well, what are my opportunity costs of doing this? Now, if you cannot make more somewhere else, then it's better to run the store, right? But if you could make more money somewhere else, it's better to hire somebody, have them run the store, and then you do that something else. And if you don't do that, then what you're giving up by running the store yourself is an implicit cost. Now, what about, okay, we got this storefront here. It's on a main road. We're in a right outside of town. We got a growing situation. The economy's growing. Population's growing. The town is growing. What might be an implicit cost in terms of the store? No, not a job. But what we're talking about, the storefront. Consider the building. What might be what might be an implicit cost? Well, the question is, what else could that land be used for? I mean, how much money are you making by running a small country general store? And how much you could be making if you were to rent that building out to someone else for maybe another type business, or maybe it would be more valuable to knock down this old building and use the land for something else. Maybe you've got this small general store with this old building on it, and maybe if you tore it down and put a motel on it, you could make, you know, that land would be a whole lot more valuable. See what I mean? I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities here. So you got to ask yourself, well, now, if I could use this building, or if I could use this land for something else, and I could make more money in that something else, then I'm experiencing an implicit cost, right? I'm giving up. By continuing operating the store, I'm giving up something because I'm not tearing down the store and maybe putting a motel on it, on the land, see? Okay, so any questions about the difference between explicit costs and implicit costs?
If you own a store like a year ago,
Well, now that's an excellent question, because what is the only thing in life we know is going to happen? Well, things are going to change, right? Change is inevitable, right? And so what was a good decision maybe a year ago may not be a good decision today. It's like with those implicit costs. I mean, maybe several years ago, maybe the best thing you could have done was run this small country store. But things change. So what was a good decision then may not be a good decision today, see? So all of this decision-making has got to be updated because things change. So what are total costs? Explicit cost plus implicit cost equals total cost. At least that's one way of looking at total cost. There are different ways of looking at total cost, but one way is cost is explicit cost plus implicit cost. Now this is, don't take this lightly. There is a world of difference between an accountant and an economist. Now, if I were an accountant and you were to ask me, what are my costs of a four-year education? I would say, well, let's see, you've got tuition, you've got books, you've got transportation, maybe you've got some babysitting expenses. So those are the costs of your... You add all those up over 4 years, and that's the cost of your education. As an economist, now let's say I'm no longer an accountant, but I'm an economist. And you come to me and say, what are my costs of a four-year education? And I'd say, well, let's see, you've got the tuition, you've got books, you've got the travel, you've got the possible babysitting expenses, and... Now, here's where I may differ from an accountant. And you have certain implicit costs. In other words, because you went to school for 4 years, how much money have you given up by not working full time? Maybe as a student, even if you did work, you know, many of you work, so you know, let's say you work part-time, well, are you making as much money in your part-time job as you could at a full-time job if it were not for your school? Now, what you've got to do is you've got to say, okay, how much money have I made over my 4 years? Whoops, you missed it. Want to close my way? How much money have I made over my 4 years because I was a student? And how much money could I have made over my 4 years if I didn't have my school schedule and time spent studying and things like that? Let's say that over the four-year period you made $8,000, but maybe if it weren't for your school, you could have made, let's say, $28,000. So what's your implicit cost? $20,000. So as an economist, if you would ask me, what is the total cost of my education, I would have to say, well, your books and your tuition, but I also have to add that
$20,000. But what about the money that you would make after you're done with college?
Well, no, we're not concerned about that. No, we're simply saying the day you graduate, how much did your degree cost you? And what I'm saying, now, Do economists consider implicit costs because accountants, because they're smarter than accountants? Because accountants haven't discovered implicit costs yet? No. The difference is that accounting and economics are two different disciplines, right? Now the questions that an accountant would ask, there's no need to consider implicit costs. But the questions that an economist would ask require an understanding and an inclusion of implicit costs when considering total costs. Now, y'all with me on this? See, what I'm doing here, and especially in this chapter, is I'm setting the ground rules. See, we're entering this this segment of economics called price determination, and I'm setting the ground rules. So in order for you to understand what's coming up, you've got to have a firm foundation with the ground rules. Okay? Okay, so what is accounting profit? Total revenue minus explicit costs. Now, there are different type of profits. There's different type of profit in economics. Accounting profit is total revenue minus explicit costs. Now, what is economic profit? See, this is another type of profit. What is economic profit? Economic profit is a firm's total revenue minus its explicit and implicit costs. Now, if we can say profit in economics, which profit do we mean? Yeah. Or in other words, economic profit. Right, exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. Now, if I just say profit, you know I'm talking about economic profit. And economic profit considers implicit costs. Now, if I want to talk about accounting profit, I would have to say accounting profit. Because then you know, well, we're not considering implicit costs here. But that doesn't happen very often. Almost always in economics, if we're talking about profit, because of the nature of the questions we're asking, we are implying economic profit, which includes implicit costs as well as explicit costs. All right? All right, what is a fixed resource? Any production cost that does not increase as output increases. So it's just what it says. You own a business. Again, you got to assume that you own a business here. So as an owner of a business, you have fixed costs and you have variable costs, or fixed resources and variable resources. Now, what would be some examples of a fixed resource? Water, maybe water. Yeah, I would say. You use a certain amount of water on a regular basis every month. That may vary in a little bit, but essentially that might be a fixed cost.
Utilities,
yeah, things like that. At least now, it would be a fixed cost, of course, if nothing changed. Now, if we're going to pay a certain amount of our utilities, at least a minimum amount every month, that would be a fixed cost. But now, if every time we increase production, which maybe we do on a regular basis, and we use more energy, then that part of our energy would be a variable resource. So certain part of our energy might be fixed, but other parts may be variable. Maybe we've got certain executives, CEOs working for us, and they're on a salary. So we're paying them a certain amount of money per year. They work many hours or few hours, we still pay them the same salary. So that salary would be a fixed cost, right? Now, if we have an hourly worker, and we're paying this hourly worker only in accordance to the hours they work, and they work different hours depending on our traffic flow, then the money that we're paying this hourly person would be a variable cost, you see? So there are fixed costs and variable costs, or fixed resources and variable resources. What are some examples of a fixed resource? Well, rent or mortgage, loan payments, certain salaries, part of utilities, property taxes would be a fixed resource. And, of course, a variable cost, any production cost that increases, output increases. Or, of course, decreases as output decreases. Variable. Variable comes from the word vary. So anything that varies with our level of output would be a variable cost. So what is total cost? Well, another way of looking at total cost would be fixed cost plus variable cost. right? Fixed cost plus variable cost equals total cost. FC is fixed cost, VC is variable cost. Okay, so here we're just, I took this from the textbook. And this is an accountant of the Wheeler dealer, and it just gives you examples of explicit costs and implicit costs. And I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but it's just this is slide 16, exhibit 1, and it just gives you examples in dollar figures of explicit costs and implicit costs, variable costs, fixed costs. Okay, what is normal profit? Now, just as there are different types of profit, well, this is another example of a different type of profit. You know, we had economic profit, we had accounting profit, right? Well, now we're looking at normal profit. What is normal profit? The accounting profit earned when all resources used by the firm earn their opportunity costs. Well, by looking at this definition, you'd have a hard time really understanding what normal profit is. So the way I like to explain normal profit is, normal profit is the minimum amount of money that you'll accept while running this business. All right? See, now, if you have a job, is there a certain minimum amount of money that you accept to continue working for your employer? Yeah. Now, and by the way, that minimum amount that you're willing to accept would be a necessary expense of the business owner, correct? The business owner needs employees. And the amount of money he pays his employees, at least a certain minimum amount that he pays employees, would be a necessary expense of running the business, correct? All right. Is there a minimum amount of money that the business owner will accept to continue operating the business? Same thing, right? The same thing applies to the business owner as applies to the wage earner. A business owner is going to run the business. He says to himself, well, if I make X number of dollars, I'll continue running this business. And if I make less than that, then I'll go do something else. Because I've got opportunity costs, right? I could be doing other things. Now, whatever that minimum amount is for the business owner, where he says, I got to make at least this amount to continue running this business, whatever amount that is, that's what we call normal profit. Now, remember I said, is there a certain minimum amount of money that the wage earner will accept to run, to work, and therefore that's a necessary expense of running the business, right? Well, is normal profit a necessary expense of running the business?
Yes.
In other words, we're saying the business owner's got to make X number of dollars or he'll shut down the business and go do something else. Right? That's what we're saying? Well, if that be the case, then is that minimum amount of money that the business owner will accept a necessary expense of running the business? And the answer is yes. Therefore, now this it's hard to get used to, but what we're saying here is that normal profit is a necessary expense. It's a cost to the business. All right? Now, all this fits in terms of definitions, and you'll see why this is so important as we go along. You know, there's some examples of this. Y'all know the big, y'all aware of the big flare-up over the weekend of AIG, you know, American International Group, paying out $165 million in bonuses. You know, the federal government, you know, over the past several months has given AIG $165 billion so they can continue to operate. And then they, you know, then they've taken a part of that money and paid a group of executives. What was it? What did I say? $165 million, right? Well, what's their justification of paying these bonuses? Of course, now these bonuses, by the way, was a contractual agreement before the government gave the bailout. All right, which is causing some real problems because of the contractual law, and if you understand, you know, the rule of law. But what is AIG's justification for paying out $165 million in bonuses? Well, yes. See, the point they're making, they're saying, well, look, if we don't pay out these big bonuses, these very knowledgeable and how you say, these valuable people will go do something else. See, in other words, what are we talking about here? We're talking about opportunity cost, right? See, these certain CEOs, well, they'll continue doing what they're doing, but they got to be paid a certain amount of money because they've got opportunity costs. And if they can make more money going to do something else, then that's what they'll do. So AIG is saying, well, and other companies too, not just AIG, but it's you know, all. I mean, this is corporate America. That you know, bonuses is a big part of corporate America. I mean, you get a salary, but then you also get a bonus on top of your salary. And companies pay out these big bonuses because it's a competitive situation. And they're saying that people in these high echelons are it's competitive. And if we don't pay them these big bonuses, someone else could come along and pay them a bigger bonus, and then we're going to lose all these skilled people. You see what I mean? So that's AIG's justification for paying out these bonuses. So, you know, all this fits into normal profit. Now, if these CEOs were business owners, which they're not, but if they were, they're saying, well, I've got to make at least $30 million a year or $50 million a year, or I'll go do something else. Well, if a business owner says, I've got to make at least $30 million a year or go do something else, what's that $30 million a year? That's normal profit. And a necessary expense of running the business. Y'all with me on this? Okay. So why is normal profit included as part of total cost? And I already answered this. Because just as in the payment of wages, normal profit is a necessary expense of running a business. Okay. What does it mean that a firm is breaking even? It is making a normal profit. Now, here's something that you've got to get used to, but it all involves definitions. You see, if we include normal profit as part of our cost data, then if we take total revenue minus total costs, we might say, well, if total revenue minus total cost is zero, right? Total revenue minus total cost is zero. You might say, well, we're exactly breaking even, right? Well, we are, but it's not what most people would think. Because if total revenue minus total cost is zero, what's actually happening? Come on now, what's happening? If total learning minus total cost is zero, does that mean that we're making zero money or zero profit? No.
You still make profit if the total revenue minus total cost?
Yeah. If total revenue minus total cost is zero, what's happening? Now, you're missing the point here. I just been talking about the fact that we include normal profit as part of our cost data. Therefore, if total revenue minus total cost is zero, what's happening? The firm is making a normal profit. Yeah, if we say they're breaking even, that means by definition that the business owner is making a normal profit. Now, what's normal profit for one person may not be normal profit for another. Like if you own a business and you made, let's say, $100,000 a year, you say, well, that's I'm satisfied with that, and as long as I make $100,000 a year, then I'll go, I'll stay doing what I'm doing, and so $100,000 is normal profit for the business. But now someone else, like these CEOs we're talking about, again, you know, they're not business owners, but we're talking about the concept. I mean, these CEOs might say, well, I've got to make at least $50 million a year, or I'll go do something else. Well, what's normal profit for them? Well, it's $50 million a year. You know, for you it's $100,000. For them it's $50 million. See, normal profit is in the eyes of the beholder. Normal profit is can differ from one business owner to another. From one it might be high, from another it might be low. But whatever it is, it's the minimum amount of money that the owner will receive or go do something else. All right? And if total revenue minus total cost is zero, by definition, now, we're talking here about definitions. By definition, the firm is making a normal profit. All right? Now, what kind of profit are they making if total revenue minus total cost is a positive number? They're making an economic profit. See, anything made above and beyond a normal profit is an economic profit. So like if the business owner says, well, I've got to make at least $1 million a year or I'll go do something else because my opportunity costs. And they make $1.5 million a year, then what's economic profit? $500,000. See, the million would be normal profit, right? But the $500,000 above and beyond the one million would be economic profit. So if total revenue minus total cost is, let's say, $1 million, then what's that $1 million? Well, that $1 million is economic profit.
I thought that
would be a normal profit. No. If total revenue total cost is zero, then the firm is exactly making a normal profit. But if total revenue minus total cost is $1 million, then that $1 million is economic profit because that's money made above and beyond a normal profit, which is a definition of economic profit. Are y'all getting the idea that you can't just use your common knowledge on these things? I mean, if you come in here and rely on your thought, yeah, your previous thought process or your how you would normally before this course define certain things, well, you'd be hopelessly lost, and you'd fail this course. All right? So you've got to be aware of these definitions and concepts and know how to apply them to answer certain economic questions. That's what this thing is all about. And it takes a lot more than... Now, common sense, see, I've told you before that most of economics is just common sense. It's just using your logic. But there's a caveat to that. What's the caveat? Well, the caveat to that is, well, yeah, it's just logical thinking, but it's got to be logical thinking within the framework of knowing the definitions and knowing certain concepts. Well, I mean, once you know the definitions and once you understand the concepts, then you use your logical common sense reasoning power to reason out the correct answer to certain problems. But without that, without the understanding of the terminology and without the understanding of certain concepts, you can't use your logical thinking in economics to come up with the right answers. Now, y'all with me on this? It's a very important that's very important for you to know. Okay, what is another way I can define economic profit? Any money made and beyond a normal profit. So I got ahead of myself. Economic profit is any money made above and beyond a normal profit. Now, again, if I just say profit, what kind of profit do I mean? Economic profit. Not normal profit, not accounting profit, but economic profit. And if I want to talk about normal profit, I've got to say normal profit. If I want to talk about accounting profit, I've got to say accounting profit. But if I don't say anything, I just say profit, then you've got to assume that I'm talking about economic profit. Again, that's, you know, rules of the game. That's just the way it is. Okay, now what is my marginal revenue? Now here is probably the most important concept of economics, but particularly microeconomics. The concept of the margin. Very, very important. Now, we've already talked about the margin before. What does the term margin mean? We've used it before, several times. What does the word margin mean? Margin means the last unit. Number uno, the last unit, margin. Therefore, what is marginal revenue? Yeah, or how much revenue did you make on the last unit? That's marginal revenue. Now, what's marginal cost?
The last unit, how much you paid for the last unit.
Yeah. What is your cost by making the last unit? Now, the key word here is what? No. Well... No, last. You see, you had to either one of them got to be the right answer, right? But the point here is last. Last. See, it's not an average. It's not a summation. It's not a total. But it's just the last one. Just the last one. Okay, that's what margin means. Margin revenue is how much did I make on. Revenue that I make on the last unit. See, marginal cost is what did that last unit cost me to produce? Now, another very important concept. Short run. Now, we talk about short run versus long run. And without knowing anything about economics, you would say, well, the short run would be a short period of time, and the long run would be a long period of time, right? But that's not the way it is in economics. The short run could be 100 years, and the long run could be 1 week. So the difference between short run and long run does not involve time. All right? But we have a very definite definition of what short run is and what long run is, which we're going to talk about right now. So what is the short run? A period during which at least one of your firm's resources are fixed. Now, I have to expand upon this. The short run is a period of time that you can increase your production, but you cannot increase or decrease your plant capacity. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say that these rooms here were, we got two rooms here, right? One here in Dublin, or one over there at the mall. And we've got X number of seats here, right? We've got, 30 seats here in Dublin. We got maybe 40 over there at the mall. And let's say that each of these seats represents one machine. And I own the business, and you all work for me, and you all work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And you are my only employees at this point. Now, y'all get the picture? I mean, we've got a room here, four walls, X amount of square feet, right? We got a room over there at the mall, four walls, X number of square feet. We got X number of machines. Let's say we got 70 machines, there's just really, let's say there, I don't know how many of you are here. Let's say there's 25 of you here total. So there's 25. We've got a whole lot more machines here than we do a number of workers, right? Now, in the short run, how could we increase our production? Come on now, what's the most obvious way? Hire more people, right? We got lots of empty seats here, correct? We got lots of machines that are just lying idle, right? So we could hire enough people to run each of these machines, correct? But they'll still be working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Okay, what else could I do? Now, what I want to do is I want to increase my production, but I cannot increase my plant capacity. Now, what else could I do?
Work more hours,
right? I mean, you're my only employees. You're working 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. I could have you work 6 days a week, 7 days a week, 8 hours a day. Plus, I could have a second shift, right? And I could have a third shift. I mean, why is 8 hours a standard work day? Because 3 times 8 equals 24, right? Or 24 hours in a day. So we can divide the day in 3 equal parts. So I can have 3 shifts of 8 hours apiece operating 7 days a week, correct? And there are other things I may be able to do in the short run. I may be able to experiment with soundproofing the walls, so maybe the workplace is quieter. I could experiment in positioning you differently. Maybe some of you would work better if you had a shield around you, like your own cubicle. You know what I mean? Maybe soft music would help. Certain incentives might help. If you perform a certain task in a certain amount of time, maybe you get a bonus. You could use imagination, and there are different things I can do to increase my production while not increase my plant capacity. But there's a point of which I cannot go any farther, right? I mean, you know, once I got enough workers, we're working 24 hours a day, all machines are used. I've experimented with different locations and soundproofing the walls and music or no music, and you know what I mean? I mean, I'm going to reach a point where I just can't, I can't increase my production anymore. Well, once I reach that point, what can I do to increase my production? Come on now. I'm going to go from the short run to the long run. Now, the long run is a period of time that we can change our plant capacity, either increase or decrease. So what kinds of things, anything's possible. What could I do, beyond this point where I can't go any farther in the short run? I could move my business. I could buy a bigger building. But once I build a bigger building, what have I done? I've changed what? I've changed my capacity. And so I have gone from the short run situation to a long run situation. Or how about if I, maybe each of these workstations required a computer. And the computers are old and outdated. And I bought new computers. But what have I done as a result? I've changed my capacity. See, that's changing capacity. I mean, if each computer is, five times faster than the old ones, then my capacity to produce has increased that much, right? So if I were to replace my present computers with new computers, or if I were to bring in a faster software program, perhaps. See, now I've left the short run and gone into the long run. Now y'all see my point? Now, what we do in economics is that we always assume the short run, unless otherwise stated. See, I might talk about this and that, and this works this way, and this equals that, and all the time. See, I'm talking about the short run. Now, if I want to talk about the long run, where our capacity can change, by the rules of the game, I have to say in the long run, such and such and such and such. Now, the reason why this is important, you see, is that if we're talking about the short run, there's a very defined and maybe a minimal number of factors that can change. At least those factors that can be changed are apparent and very measurable. Right? But if I talk about the long run, what's the story? Well, now anything can change. Anything's possible. See? So if we're talking about this and that and everything else, and we're assuming the short run, well, our mode of thinking is within this small context. And if we go into the long run, then the number of possibilities, like maybe change exponentially, and well, almost anything's possible. So it's much simpler, and we can come to some definite conclusions if we concentrate on the short run. And that's why we use the short run, long run in economics. We use the short run so that we're more clearly defining what it is that we're measuring. Yeah. No, short run. Because we're not. You can increase their salaries, but you're not increasing their capacity. Well, no, we're not about fixed. Well, we're talking about capacity. See, I could pay you more money, but whatever your capacity is, it hasn't changed. I mean, you're still you.
Like what? When you had when you define short run on the board, like it puts fixed resources in there rather than like capacity.
if you were to bring up the definition of short run up there, it has fixed resource in there, and is that okay?
Well, that's why I had explained this. I mean, it's hard for me to explain something in just a few short words.
Right.
A period during which at least one of the firm's resources are fixed. Well, that's a very brief definition of the short run.
Okay.
So that's why you can't rely on these slides alone. These slides are just a very brief outline. You can't rely on these slides to really understand the term, because you just can't do it in one slide. I took this definition from the book, but there's a lot more involved here. And there are different ways of explaining things, and what I just explained to you is my way of explaining it. So my way of explaining it is capacity. You know, the word capacity is really the key difference between short run and long run. You know, in economics, we're almost always talking about the short run. There's a story about John Maynard Keynes, and he was giving a talk, and he was saying this and he was saying that, and someone asked him a question. Well, they said, Mr. Keynes, you say this and you say that. This is true and that's true in the short run, but what about the long run? He says, well, in the long run, we're all dead anyway, so what difference does it make? I mean, see, in the long run, anything can happen, right? I mean, we might be hit by a meteor, and everything we know on Earth, is gone in the twinkling of an eye. I mean, anything is possible in the long run. So in economics, we talk about the short run. See, what is the long run? A period during which all your resources under your firm's control are variable. See, anything can happen. Anything can change in the long run. And the short run relationship between units of labor and tons of furniture moved. And here, see, I put these tables in and graphs in because so much of what we do is interpreting tables and graphs. Now, what is the advantage of a table over a graph? If I'm trying to explain something and I use a table rather than a graph, what would my purpose be in using the table? My purpose in using the table is that a table can normally be more detailed than a graph. There's more numbers on a table. It's more detailed. Now, what's the disadvantage of a table over a graph? The disadvantage of a table is that it's more difficult to see the bigger picture. Now, what's the advantage of a graph over a table? Huh? The advantage of a graph over a table is that it's easier to see the bigger picture with a graph. You can see at a step back and see the bigger picture with a graph more than you can with a table. But what's the disadvantage of a graph? Well, it can't always be as detailed as a table. So if I want to be very detailed and talk about the specifics, I'll use a table. But if I want to just talk about the bigger picture and show you relationships, then I'll use a graph. And there's lots of graphs and tables in economics. And so a big part of this principles of economics is learning how to glean information, learning how to read tables and graphs. Knowing the definitions, having a working knowledge of the concepts, and then learning how to apply these concepts to glean information from tables and graphs to make decisions. Right? See, that's what microeconomics is all about. Microeconomics gives us the tools that we use to make right decisions. All right? So, here we have a table. The first column, we have a variable resource, like labor per day. Second column, we have total product. So total product goes 2, 5, 9, 12, etc. So in other words, the more labor we have, what's happening? Yeah, the more, you know, we increase the total product. Now, in the third column, we have marginal product. Now, what this says here is that if we go from, let's say, we go from one resource to one labor to two labors, our marginal product is 3. You see that 3 on the third column? This says that if we go from one laborer to two laborers, one worker to two workers, our marginal product is 3. Now, how do we come up with the number 3?
5 minus 2.
Exactly. 5 minus 2, because what is marginal product? Marginal product is how much product did we gain on the last unit, correct? In this case, unit is workers. So in other words, if our total product at one worker is 2, and our total product at two workers is 5, how much did we add to our total product as we went from 1 to 2? 3. Now, how do we get 4 as we went? Now, notice here, I'm not saying 4 is the situation at 3 units. What I'm saying here is, see, it's a transition thing. It's a transition thing. So what I'm saying is that as we go from having 2 workers to having 3 workers, how much can we add to our total product? 4. Well, how do we come up with 4?
9 minus 5 is 4.
See, if our total product of 2 workers is 5, and our total product of 3 workers is 9, then how much do we add to our total product by the third worker? 4. Now, see how we come up with this?
Yeah.
Again, you know, a big part of like this this test that you have on this, you're going to be given a table. And on this table, you might have most of the first column and maybe the second column, and then maybe the third column will be blank. And then the question is, well, now, what is your marginal product as we go from 3 workers to 4 workers? And you're going to have to say, well, let's see, now at 3 workers, our total product is 9. At 4 workers, our total product is 12. So our marginal product has to be
12 minus 9 or 3.
See, so it's quite simple if you understand the concepts. And in this case, the concept of the margin. Now, the margin, I've given you examples before of the margin, and of course, you're going to be given a lot of practice with it beginning with the next chapter. But the concept of the margin involves the decision-making process. In fact, it's called marginal analysis. Marginal analysis. The decision-making process of economics involves marginal analysis, thinking on the margin. Okay? In fact, I gave you examples before of marginal revenue and marginal cost and how many units we produce to maximize our profit. I'm not going to go, we're running out of time, but you'll get a lot of practice with this in the next chapter. So before we go, any questions about this? I mean, This is not an easy segment, and you've really got to buckle down and make sure you understand these basic concepts, or you're really going to get hopelessly lost.
Would you say in the short run, with this resource, with the capacity of workers, like when you use that example?
Well, yeah. Well, that's one way of looking at your capacity and workers. There's other ways of looking at it, but...
Because I'm just trying to associate the whole... saying you have something's fixed in the short run.
Well, don't concentrate on the word fixed. Just concentrate on the word capacity.
Just
capacity. In the short run is a period of time that you can increase your production... But you cannot increase your plant capacity. So you can increase the number of units by doing things like I showed you, but you can't change your capacity to produce in the short run. Because once you change your capacity, then you're in the long run. So this is slide 25, so we'll pick up with slide 26 here in chapter 7 next time. So I'll see you all next time.